Chapter 14. The artillery batteries were trading hot words before Lawrence had even left Hohenlohe's tent. Already the fastest couriers were flying desperately after Brunswick and the King and westward to call in the reserves from Weimar. There was no option now but to concentrate as quickly as possible and give battle. For his own part, Lawrence could be almost thankful for the French catching them, if not for the suddenness of their assault. It seemed to him, as it had to Temeraire, that the commanders had laboured desperately the last week to avoid the very war which they had provoked, and which all their men were prepared to endure. A stupid, cowering sort of delay that could only wear down morale, reduce their supply, and leave detachments exposed and vulnerable to being cut down one by one, as poor Prince Louis had been. The prospect of action had quite swept away the malaise hanging upon the camp, and the iron discipline and drill was telling in their favour. As he walked swiftly through the ranks, he heard laughter and joking tones. The order to stand to was met everywhere with an instant response, and though the men were themselves in sorry case, wet and pinched with hunger, they had kept their arms in good order, and their colours sprang out gaily overhead, the great banners snapping in the wind like musket shot.
"Lawrence, hurry, hurry! They are fighting already without us!"
Temeraire called urgently, sitting up high on his back legs with his head craned out of the covert, spotting Lawrence before he had even reached the clearing.
"I promise you we will have enough fighting today, however late we enter the fray,"
Lawrence said, leaping into Temeraire's waiting claw with a speed that belied his counsel of patience, and swinging himself rapidly into place with the aid of Granby's outstretched hand. All the crew were already in their places, the Prussian officers no less than the British, and Badenhauer, who was trained as a signal officer, sat anxiously beside Lawrence's own place.
"Mr. Fellows, Mr. Keynes, I trust you will make the safety of the eggs your first concern,"
Lawrence called down, locking his carabiners onto the harness just in time. Temeraire was already launching himself aloft, and the only answer Lawrence got was their waving hands, any words inaudible in the rush of wing-beats as they drove towards the front lines of the battlefield, to engage the oncoming French advance guard. Some hours later, the morning's first skirmishing done, Eroica led them to ground in a small valley where the dragons might snatch a few swallows of water and catch their breath. Temeraire, Lawrence was glad to see, was holding up well and little affected in his spirits, though they might be said to have suffered a repulse. There had been little hope, indeed, of keeping the French from gaining a foothold, not under the guns which had already been established on the heights. At least they had been made to pay for the ground which they had won, and the Prussians had gained enough time to deploy their own regiments. Far from dismayed, Temeraire and the other dragons were rather more excited at having fought, and full of anticipation of still more battle to come. Too, they had benefited from their work. Few were the dragons who had not managed to seize a dead horse or two to eat, so they were better fed than they had been for many a day, and full of the resultant energy. Waiting their turns to drink, they even engaged in calling across the valley to one another with accounts of their individual bravery, and how they had done for this enemy dragon and that. These Lawrence judged to be exaggerated, as the entire plain was not littered with the corpses of their victims, but no scruples on this account arrested their pleasure in boasting. The men stayed aboard, passing around canteens and biscuit, but the captains gathered to consult for a few moments.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said to him, as he climbed down to join the others, "this horse I am eating looks very odd to me. It is wearing a hat."
The limp and dangling head was covered with an odd sort of hood, attached to the bridle and made of some thin cotton stuff, very light, but with stiff wooden cuffs almost encircling the eye-holes, and some sort of pouches covering the nostrils. Temeraire held it for him, and Lawrence cut away one of the pouches with his knife, a sachet of dried flowers and herbs. And though it was soaked through now with blood and the horse's damp, sweating breath, Lawrence could still smell the strong perfume beneath.
"Over the nose like that, it must keep them from smelling the dragons and getting spooked,"
Granby said, having come down to look at it with him.
"I dare say that is how they manage cavalry around dragons in China."
"That is bad, very bad," Dyhern said, when Lawrence had shared the intelligence with him. "It means they will be able to use their cavalry under dragon fire, when we cannot use ours. Schleitz, you had better go and tell the generals," he added to the captain of one of his lightweights,
and the man nodded and dashed back to his dragon. They had been aground for scarcely 15 minutes, but they rose up to find the world already changed. The great contest now was unfolding fully beneath them,
like nothing Lawrence had ever seen. Across full 5 miles of villages and fields and woods the battalions were forming, ironwork and steel blazing in the sun amid a sea of colour, uniforms of green and red and blue in their thousands, in their tens of thousands, all the massed regiments filing into their battle lines like a monstrous ballet, to the accompaniment of the shrill animal cries of horses, the jar and clatter of the wheels of the supply carts, the thundercloud rumble of the field guns.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said, "how many of them there are!"
The scale might justly make even dragons feel small, a sensation Temeraire could hardly have been less used to. He halted in place and hovered uncertainly, gazing over the battlefield. Clouds of white-grey gunpowder smoke were blowing across the fields and tangling into the forests of oak and pine. There was some hard fighting continuing on the Prussian left, around a small village, better than 10,000 men engaged, Lawrence guessed, and for all that inconsequential. Elsewhere the French had paused to reinforce their lines, in the space which they had already gained. Men and horses were pouring over the bridges of the Saale, the eagles of their standards shining gold, and still more coming on dragonback. Upon the morning's first battlefield the bodies of the dead lay abandoned by both sides. Only victory or time would see them buried. Temeraire said, low,
"I did not know battles could be so large. Where are we to go? Some of those men are far away. We cannot help all of them."
"We can but play our own part as best we can," Lawrence answered him. "It is not for any one man or dragon to win the day. That is the business of the generals. We must look sharp to our orders and our signals, and achieve what they ask of us."
Temeraire made an uneasy rumble.
"But what if we should not have very good generals?"
The question was unpleasantly apt. At once the involuntary comparison sprang to mind between that lean and glittering-eyed man on the heights, so full of certainty and command, and the old men in their pavilions with their counsels and arguments and endlessly changing orders. Below, to the back of the field, he could see Hohenlohe on his horse, his white powdered wig in place, with his knot of aides-de-camp and men running back and forth around him. Tauentzein, Holzendorf, and Blücher were moving among their separate troops. The Duke of Brunswick was not yet upon the field, his army still hurrying back from their aborted retreat. None of them distant strangers to 60, and they faced, on the French side, the marshals who had fought and clawed their way through the revolutionary wars, and the man who held their reins, any one of whom could have given them 20 years.
"Good or bad, our duty remains the same, and that of any man," Lawrence said, thrusting aside with an effort such unworthy thoughts. "Discipline on the field may win the day, even if the strategy be flawed, and its absence will ensure defeat."
"I do see," Temeraire said,
resuming his flight. Up ahead the French lightweight dragons were rising again to harry the unfolding ranks of the Prussian battalions, and Eroica and his formation had turned to meet them.
"With so many men, all must obey, or there would be no order at all. They cannot even see themselves as we can, and know how they stand in the hole."
He paused and added anxiously and low,
"Lawrence, if, only if, we were to lose this war, and the French were to try again to come into England, surely we would be able to stop them?"
"Better not to lose," Lawrence said grimly. And then they were back into the thick of it, the tableau of the battlefield dissolving into the 100 private struggles of their own corner of the war.
By the early afternoon they could feel the tide shifting in their direction for the first time. Brunswick's army was pouring back in double-quick time, long before Bonaparte could have expected them, and Hohenlohe had sent out all his battalions, 20 of them already now deployed in parade-ground form upon the open field, and preparing to make an assault against the leading corps of French infantry, who were hunkered down in a small village near the centre of the battle. Still, the French heavyweights had not engaged, and the larger Prussian dragons were growing exasperated.
As Temeraire said, "It does not feel right to me, only batting around these little fellows. Where are the big dragons from their side? This is not much of a fair fight."
By the sound of Eroica's loud and grumbling response he wholly agreed, and his swipes at the little French dragons were beginning to be desultory. At last one Prussian courier, a high-flying Mauerfuchs, risked a quick overflight of the French camp while the rest of them engaged the lightweights at close quarters. He winged back almost at once in a flurry to say the larger French dragons were no longer bringing in men, and were now all lying about on the ground, eating, and some even napping.
"Oh," Temeraire said, outraged, "they must all be great cowards, sleeping when there is a battle going on. What do they mean by it?"
"We can be grateful for it. They must have worn themselves all out, lugging about those guns," Granby said.
"Yet at this rate they will be well rested enough when they come in," Lawrence said.
Their own side had been flying hours, with only the briefest pauses for water.
"Perhaps we ought to take turns ourselves. Temeraire, will you not land a while?"
"I am not at all tired," Temeraire protested. "And look, those dragons are trying some mischief over there," he added, and dashed away without waiting for an answer,
so they all had to cling to his harness to keep from being flung off their feet as he collided mid-air with a startled and squalling pair of French lightweights, who had only been circling around looking over the battlefield, and who promptly fled his attack. Before Lawrence could renew his suggestion, loud cheering rang out below, and their attention was distracted. In the teeth of the continuing, terrible artillery fire, Queen Louise herself had come out and was galloping along the Prussian line, escorted only by a handful of dragoons, the Prussian banner streaming out brilliantly behind their little party. She wore a colonel's uniform coat over her clothing, and the stiff-sided plumed hat also, with her hair caught up snugly beneath it. The soldiers yelled her name wildly. She was perhaps the heart of the Prussian war party, and had long urged a resistance to Napoleon and his predations of Europe. Her bravery could not fail to put heart into the men. The king also was on the field, his banner showing farther on the Prussian left, and all throughout the ranks the senior officers had exposed themselves with their men to the fire. She had no sooner cleared the field than the order was given. In another sort of encouragement, bottles were going down across the front ranks, men pouring the liquor straight into their mouths. The drums beat out the signal, and the infantry charged straight out from their lines with bayonets levelled, men screaming with raw voices, and stormed into the narrow lanes of the village. The death toll was hideous. From behind every garden, wall, and window, the French sharpshooters arose and put forth a ceaseless fire, and near enough every bullet found a mark, while down the straightaways of the main tracks of the village the artillery pounded away, canister shot breaking apart into deadly shrapnel as it flew from the mouths of the guns. But the Prussians came onward with irresistible force, and one after another the guns were silenced as they poured into the farmhouses, the barns, the gardens, the pigsties, and hacked down the French soldiers at their places. The village was lost, and the French battalions were pouring out its back, retreating in good order, but retreating nonetheless, for nearly the first time that day. The Prussians roared and kept coming onwards. Behind the village they drew back together into line again under the shouts of their sergeants, and threw the terrible volley fire upon the retreating French again.
"That is a great success, Lawrence, is it not?" Temeraire said jubilantly. "And now surely we will push them back still further."
"Yes," Lawrence said,
full of inexpressible relief, leaning over to shake hands with Badenhauer in congratulation.
"Now we will see some proper work done."
But they had no further opportunity to watch the ground battle unfold. Badenhauer's hand abruptly tightened on Lawrence's with surprise, and the young Prussian officer pointed him around. From the summit of the Landgrafenberg, the massed forces of the French aerial corps were rising, the heavyweights coming to the battle at last. The Prussian dragons gave almost as one a loud roar of delight, and full of renewed energy began to shout out taunting remarks on the subject of the French dragons' late entry to the field as they waited for the others to move into formation and close. The French lightweights, who had so valiantly held the field all day, made now one heroic final effort and kept up a sort of screen before the oncoming dragons, darting back and forth around the Prussians' heads to obscure their view, wings flapping distractingly in their faces. The bigger dragons impatiently snorted and lashed out here and there, but without much attention, rather craning their heads to see. Only at the last moments did the lightweights pull away, and Lawrence saw the French were not coming in formation at all. Or almost. There was one formation, the plainest imaginable, only a wedge but made entirely of heavyweights, in the lead one Grand Chevalier, leaner but with broader shoulders than Eroica, and behind him three petit chevaliers, each one bigger than Temeraire, and behind them a row of six chansons de guerre, only a little smaller, incongruously cheerful in appearance with their orange and yellow markings. They might all have been formation leaders in their own right. Instead they made one enormous, if lumbering, group, surrounded by a vast, unformed crowd of middleweights.
"Well, that's never a Chinese strategy," Granby said, staring. "What the devil are they trying now?"
Lawrence shook his head, perplexed. They had seen a few military reviews amongst the Chinese dragons, who operated aloft more nearly as men did upon the ground, drilling in lines and columns, and never in so confused a manner. Eroica and his formation anchored the centre of the Prussian line, and now, with bared teeth, he threw himself forward to meet the Grand Chevalier, crying out in a ringing challenge. The Prussian colours were streaming out from his shoulders like another pair of wings. The two formations increased their speed as they drew nearer one another. The miles turned into yards, and then feet, and then vanished altogether. The collision was at hand, and then the moment was past, and Eroica turned round, bewildered and indignant in mid-air. The big French dragons had, one and all, swerved to go past him and gone straight for the wings of his formation, the ranks of smaller middleweights.
"Feiglings!"
Eroica bellowed after them at the top of his lungs as they clawed and scattered his wing dragons. He had been left flying almost alone, and even as he came around to the attack again, three of the French middleweights seized the opening and drew up alongside him. They were too small to do him any direct harm, and did not even try, but their backs were crammed full of men. No less than three boarding parties leapt over, almost 20 men, swords and pistols in their hands, grabbing at his harness. Eroica's crew burst into activity to hold off the new threat, all the riflemen bringing up their guns, and a sudden spatter of musket shot rang out, making the raised sword blades sing in high, clear notes as the bullets struck them. Thick streams of gunpowder smoke boiled away as Eroica thrashed in the air frantically, head going this way and that as he tried to see what was going toward and protect his captain. His efforts threw off many of the hapless boarders who went flailing through the air, but others had already latched themselves on securely, and Eroica was throwing his own crew off their feet as well as the boarders. The confusion served the French with a lucky stroke. Two lieutenants clinging to one another for support kept their feet after one of these mid-air convulsions, when all the crew had been flung down, and in the momentary gap they sprang forward and hacked off the carabiner straps of some 8 men, sending them tumbling free to their deaths. The rest of the struggle was sharp but brief as the boarding parties advanced in force upon the dragon's neck. Dihern shot 2 men and killed another with a sabre thrust, but then his blade lodged in the man's chest and would not come out again, and the falling body ripped it from his hands. The French seized his arms and put a blade to his throat, calling to Eroica, "Geben Sie oben!" while they pulled down the Prussian flags and put the tricolour in its place. It was a terrible loss, and one which they could not avert. Temeraire himself was being hotly pursued by 5 middleweights, similarly overburdened with men, and all his speed and ingenuity were required to avoid them. Now and again a few men would take the desperate risk and leap across onto his back, even though they were not very close, but few enough that Temeraire flung them off at once with a quick, writhing turn, or the top men cut them down with sword or pistol. But an honneur d'or, greatly daring, flung herself directly at Temeraire's head. He ducked instinctively, and as she whisked by overhead, a couple of her bellmen let go and dropped aboard directly onto Temeraire's shoulders, flattening young Allen and knocking Lawrence and Badenhauer into a tangled sprawl of straps and limbs. Lawrence grabbed blindly for some purchase. Badenhauer was with an excess of courage trying to throw himself atop Lawrence protectively and getting in the way of his putting himself back on his feet. But the act was justified. He sank back, gasping, into Lawrence's arms, blood spreading dark from a stab wound through his shoulder. The Frenchman who had dealt the blow was drawing back the sword for another attempt. Granby, with a shout, threw himself against the handful of attackers and heaved them back 3 paces. Lawrence at last righted himself and cried out. Granby had thrown off his straps to make the attack, and the pair of French officers, seizing him by the arms, flung him over the side.
"Temeraire!" Lawrence shouted. "Temeraire!"
The earth dropped out from beneath his feet. Temeraire doubled on himself and plunged after Granby's falling body, wings driving. Lawrence could not breathe for the sickening, dizzying speed of it, the blurred ground hurtling towards them and a humming like the sound of bees all around them, from the flight of bullets through the air as they came low over the battlefield. And then Temeraire corkscrewed up and away, his tail smashing to flinders a slim young oak tree. Lawrence clawed himself hand over hand up the straps and looked over Temeraire's shoulder. Granby lay in Temeraire's talons, gasping, trying to staunch the blood streaming from his nostrils. Lawrence rolled to his feet and went for his sword. The Frenchmen were leaping to the attack again. He smashed the pommel into the first one's face savagely and felt the bone crush beneath his gloved fist. Then he ripped the blade free from the sheath and swung at the second. It was the first time he had struck a flesh blow with a Chinese sword. It bowled the man's head off with scarcely any resistance. From startlement and reaction, Lawrence stood gawking at the headless body, its hand still clinging to its sword. Then, belatedly, Alan jumped to his duty and cut the Frenchman's straps, so their bodies fell away, and Lawrence was recalled to himself. He wiped his sword hurriedly and put it back away, hauling himself gratefully back into his place on Temeraire's neck. The French had turned their successful manoeuvre against the other formations one at a time, the heavyweights throwing themselves en masse against the wings, isolating the leaders so the middleweights could pounce. Eroica was flying away, wretchedly, with hang-dog head, and not alone. Three more Prussian heavyweight dragons followed him in short order, all of them beating so slowly they were descending towards the ground between each wing-stroke and the next. The other members of their formations were milling uncertainly without them, slow to comprehend the abrupt losses. Ordinarily, the members of a formation so stripped of its leader would have at once gone to support a different formation, but having been all stricken at once, they were now mostly flying into each other's way, at the mercy of their enemies. The French heavyweights massed again and brutally scattered them over and over, riflemen firing terrible barrages into their crews. Men were falling like hailstones, and the loss was so dreadful that many of the dragons cried out and yielded themselves in desperation, unboarded, to save their captains and the remnants of their crews. The last three Prussian formations, forewarned by their comrades' fate, had drawn up in tight, close ranks, protecting their leaders, but though they were successfully fending off the attempts at breaking in, they were paying with distance and position, drifting farther and farther afield under the steady pressure. Temeraire's own situation was growing increasingly desperate. He twisted and turned this way and that, constantly under fire with his own riflemen returning their own shot in bursts. Lieutenant Riggs bawling out the firing drill to keep them steady, though they were all of them reloading as fast as they could go. Temeraire's scales and the chain mail with which he was girt turned aside most of those balls which came towards him by accident, though here and again one tore through the more delicate membrane of his wings, or lodged shallowly in his flesh. He did not flinch, too full of battle fever to even feel the small wounds, but concentrated all his powers on the evasion. Even so, Lawrence thought in anguish that they too would soon be forced to flee the field or be taken. The long day's labours were telling on Temeraire, and his turns were slowing. To quit the field, to desert under fire without an order to retreat, he could hardly imagine. Yet the Prussians themselves were giving way, and if he did not withdraw, aside from the very great evil of their own capture, the eggs were almost sure to fall into enemy hands as well. Lawrence had no desire to so recompense the French for having taken Temeraire's egg from them. He was on the point of calling Temeraire away, at least for a breath, when his conscience was spared. A clarion roar sounded, musical and terrible at once, and with breathtaking suddenness their enemies vanished away. Temeraire whirled around three times before he was satisfied he had indeed been left in peace, and only then risked hovering long enough for Lawrence to see what was going forward. The ringing call was Lien's voice. She had not herself taken part in the battle, but she was hovering now in mid-air, behind the lines of the French dragons. She had no harness nor crew, but the great diamond upon her forehead was glowing fiery orange with the reflected sunset, almost to match the virulence of her red eyes. She cried out again, and Lawrence heard another drumming below. Signals flying from the French ranks, and at the crest of the hill on a grey charger, Bonaparte himself watching over the field, the breastplates of the feared Imperial Guard behind him molten gold in the light. The Prussian formations dispersed or driven off, the French dragons had acquired a clear dominance over the aerial arena. Now in answer to Lien's call, they all moved together into a straight-line formation. Below, the French cavalry, all as one, wheeled and broke away to either side of the battlefield. All the horses spurred as quick as they could go, and the infantry fell back from the front lines, though keeping up a steady musket and artillery fire as they went. Lien rose higher into the air and drew a great breath, her ruff under its steel diadem spreading wide around her head, her sides belling out like sails overpressed with wind, and then from her jaws burst the terrible fury of the divine wind. She directed it against no target. She struck down no enemy, and dealt not a single blow, but the hideous force of it left the ears ringing, as though all the cannon in the world had gone off at once. Lien was some 30 years of age to Temeraire's two, a little larger and more experienced by far, and there was not only the power of her greater size behind it, but a sort of resonance, a rise and fall in her voice, which carried on the roaring a seemingly endless time. Men reeled back from it, all along the battlefield. The Prussian dragons huddled themselves away. Even Lawrence and his crew, familiar with the divine wind, jerked instinctively away so that their carabiner straps drew taut. A complete silence followed, broken only by small, shocked cries, the moans of the wounded on the field below. But before the echoes had stopped ringing away, all the line of French dragons lifted up their own heads and, roaring in full voice, plunged earthwards. They pulled up their dive just short of collision with the ground. Some few, indeed, were unable to do so, and tumbled out of the sky to crush great swaths of the Prussian ranks beneath their bodies, though crying out in agony as they rolled over their own wings. But the rest did not even pause. Dragging their claws and tails as they skimmed just above the ground, they went tearing through the stunned and unprepared ranks of the Prussian infantry, and they left great bloody ranks of the dead behind them as they lifted away again into the air. The men broke. Before even the dragons struck the front ranks, the lines to the rear were dissolving into utter confusion. A wild, panicked attempt at flight, men struggling with one another and trying to flee in different directions. King Frederick was standing in his stirrups, three men holding his frantic and heaving charger to keep it from throwing him off. He was shouting through a speaking trumpet while signal flags waved. "Retreat," Badenhauer said, gripping Lawrence's arm. His voice sounded utterly matter-of-fact, but his face was streaked and dirty with tears, which he did not seem even to notice he was shedding. Down on the field below, the Duke of Brunswick's limp and blood-spattered body was being carried back towards the tents. But the men were in no frame to listen, or to obey. Some few battalions managed indeed to form into square for defence, the men standing shoulder to shoulder with their bayonets bristling outwards, but others went running half-mad back through the village, through the woods, which they had only just won with so much labour, and as the French dragons dropped to the earth to rest, their blood-spattered sides heaving, the French cavalry and infantry poured all down off the hill and streamed past them, roaring in human voices, to complete the ruin and defeat. Chapter 15
"No, I'm all right," Granby said hoarsely, when they laid him out in the covert. "For God's sake, don't hold up on my account. I'm only damned tired of always getting knocked about the head."
He was shaken and ill, for all he said, and when he tried to drink a little portable soup, he vomited it up again at once. So his crewmates contented themselves with giving him enough liquor to knock him over yet again, of which he drank only a swallow or two before falling asleep. Lawrence meant to take aboard as many of the ground crews as he could, of the dragons taken prisoner. Many of the men almost refused to come, in disbelief. The covert was well to the south of the battlefield, and they had not seen the day's events. Badenhauer argued with them a long time, all of them growing increasingly loud and tense.
"Keep your damn voices down," Keynes snapped, while the crew carefully bundled the eggs back aboard into the belly rigging. "That Kazalik is mature enough by now to understand," he said to Lawrence in an undertone. "The last thing we need is for the blessed creature to be frightened in the shell. It often makes a timid beast."
Lawrence nodded grimly, and then Temeraire lifted his weary head up from the ground and looked into the darkening sky above.
"There is a fleur de nuit up there. I hear its wings."
"Tell those men they may stay and be damned, or get aboard now," Lawrence said to Badenhauer, waving his own crew aboard, and they landed outside Apolda, cold and tired and cramped.
The town was nearly a ruin. Windows smashed, wine and beer running in the gutters, stables and barns and pens all emptied. No one in the streets but drunken soldiers, bloody and ragged and belligerent. On the stoop of the largest inn, Lawrence had to step past one man, weeping like a child, into the palm of his right hand. His left was missing, the stump tied up in a rag. Inside there were only a handful of lower officers, all of them wounded or half dead of exhaustion. One had enough French to tell him,
"You must go. The French will be here by morning, if not sooner. The king has gone to Sumada."
In the back cellars Lawrence found a rack of wine bottles, unbroken, and a cask of beer. Pratt heaved the last onto his shoulder and carried it, while Porter and Winston took armfuls of bottles, and they went back to the clearing. Temeraire had smashed up an old dead oak, lightning blasted, and the men had managed to kindle a fire. He lay curved round it while the men huddled against his sides. They shared the bottles and breached the cask for Temeraire to drink, a little enough comfort, when they had at once to get aloft again. Lawrence hesitated. Temeraire was so exhausted he was swallowing with his eyes almost shut. But that fatigue was itself a danger. If a French dragon patrol came on them now, he doubted Temeraire could rouse quickly enough to escape.
"We must be away, my dear," he said gently. "Can you manage?"
"Yes, Lawrence. I am perfectly well,"
Temeraire said, struggling up onto his feet again. Though he added, low,
"Must we go very far?"
The 15-mile flight seemed longer. The town bloomed out of the dark suddenly, with a bonfire on the outskirts. A handful of Prussian dragons looked up anxiously as Temeraire landed heavily beside it, in the trampled field which was their bivouac. Lightweights and a few couriers, a couple of middleweights, not a single formation entire, and not another heavyweight among them. They crowded gladly around him for reassurance, and nudged towards him a share of the horse carcasses that were their dinner. But he tore off only a little of the flesh before he sank down quite asleep, and Lawrence left him dead to the world, many of the smaller dragons tucking themselves against his sides. He sent the men to find what cheer they could to make their camp more comfortable, and walked across the fields to the town alone. The night was quiet and beautiful. An early frost made all the stars shine bright, and his breath only briefly hung white in the air. He had not done very much fighting, but he was aching in all his parts, a clenching hot pain around his neck and shoulders, legs stiff and cramped. He stretched them gratefully. Tired cavalry horses crowded into a paddock raised their heads and whickered anxiously as he went past the fence. They smelled Temeraire upon him, he supposed. Little enough of the army had yet reached Sumada. Most fugitives had escaped on foot and would be walking through the night if they even knew to come. The town had not been looted and some measure of order was kept. The groans of the wounded marked the field hospital in a small church, and the king's hussar guards were drawn up still in ranks outside the largest building, not quite a fortress, only a solid and respectable manor. He could find no other aviators at all, nor any senior officer to make his report to, with poor Dyhern captured. He had spent some of the day in support of General Tauntzein's command, and another part under Marshal Blücher, but so far as anyone could tell him, neither was in the town. At last he went to Hohenlohe directly, but the prince was engaged in conference, and a young aide, with an officious brusqueness hardly excusable even by the weight under which they all were labouring, took him to the room and told him to wait in the hallway outside. After half an hour cooling his heels outside the door, without so much as a chair, hearing only the occasional muffled sound of voices, Lawrence sat down on the floor and put out his legs, and fell asleep, leaning against the wall. Someone was speaking to him in German.
"No, thank you,"
he said, still asleep, and then opened his eyes. A woman was looking down at him with a kind expression, but half amused. Abruptly he recognized the Queen, and a couple of guards were standing with her.
"Oh, good Lord,"
Lawrence said, and sprang to his feet with much embarrassment, begging her pardon in French.
"Oh, what a nothing," she said, and looked at him curiously. "But what are you doing here?"
She opened the door, when he had explained, and put her head in, to Lawrence's discomfort. He had much rather have waited a longer time than seem a complainer. Hohenlohe's voice answered her in German, and she beckoned Lawrence in with her. A good fire was laid on in the room, and heavy tapestries on the walls kept the cold stone from leaching away all the heat. The heat was very welcome. Lawrence had stiffened up even further from sitting in the hall. King Frederick stood leaning against the wall near the fireplace, a tired man, not as handsome or vital as his wife, with a long pale face and hair set high up on his broad white forehead. His mouth was thin, and he wore a narrow moustache. Hohenlohe stood at a large table covered over with maps. Generals Ruchel and Kalkreuth were with him. also several other staff officers. Hohenlohe stared at Lawrence unblinkingly a long moment, then with an effort said,
"Good God! Are you still here?"
Lawrence did not immediately understand how to take this, as Hohenlohe had not even known he was in the town. Then he was abruptly wide awake and furiously angry.
"I am sorry that I should have troubled you," he bit out. "As you have been expecting my desertion, I am perfectly happy to be gone." "No, nothing of the kind," Hohenlohe said, somewhat incoherently, adding, "And God in heaven, who could blame you?"
He ran his hand over his face. His wig was disordered and dingy grey, and Lawrence was sorry. Plainly, Hohenlohe did not have full command of himself.
"I have only come to make my report, sir," Lawrence said, with more moderation. "Temeraire has taken no serious injury. My losses are 3 wounded, none dead, and I have brought in some 3 dozen ground crewmen from Jena and their equipment."
"Harness and forges?"
Kalkreuth asked quickly, looking up.
"Yes, sir, though only 2 of the latter besides our own," Lawrence said. "They were too heavy to bring more."
"That is something, thank God," Kalkreuth said. "Half our harnesses are coming apart at the seams."
After this, no one else spoke for a long time. Hohenlohe was gazing fixedly at the maps, but with an expression which suggested he was not properly seeing them. General Ruchel had slipped into a chair, his face grey and tired, and the Queen was at her husband's side murmuring to him in a low, private voice in German. Lawrence wondered if he ought to ask to be excused, though he did not think they were keeping silent from any scruple at his presence. There was a very miasma of fatigue thickening the atmosphere of the room. Abruptly the King shook his head and turned back to face the room.
"Do we know where he is?"
There was no need to ask who he was.
"Anywhere south of the Elbe,"
one young staff officer muttered, and flushed as it came out over-loud in the dull room, earning him glares.
"Jena tonight, sire, surely,"
Ruchel said, still scowling at the young man. The King was perhaps the only one who took no notice of the slip of the tongue.
"Will he give us an armistice?"
"That man? Not a moment to breathe," Queen Louise said with scorn. "Nor any kind of honourable terms. I would rather throw myself completely into the arms of the Russians than grovel for the pleasure of that parvenu."
She turned to Hohenlohe.
"What can be done? Surely something can be done?"
He roused himself a little and went through his maps, pointing at different garrisons and detachments, speaking half in French and half in German of rallying the troops, falling back on the reserves.
"Bonaparte's men have been marching for weeks and fighting all day," he said. "We will have a few days, I hope, before they can organize a pursuit. Perhaps a large share of the army has escaped. They will come this way and towards Erfurt. We must gather them and fall back."
Heavy boots rang on the stones in the hallway, and a heavy hand on the door. The newcomer, Marshal Blücher, did not wait to be asked in, but came in with no more warning.
"The French are in Erfurt," he said, without ceremony, in plain, blunt German even Lawrence could understand. "Murat landed with 5 dragons and 500 men, and they surrendered. The fuckers!"
He cut off in great confusion, blushing fiery red under his moustaches. He had just seen the Queen. The others were more preoccupied with his intelligence than his language. A confused babble of voices arose, and a scramble among the staff officers through the disordered papers and maps. Lawrence could not follow the conversation, mostly in German, but that they were brangling was noisily clear.
"Enough!"
said the King, suddenly and loud, and the quarrelling faltered and stilled.
"How many men do we have?"
he asked Hohenlohe. The papers were shuffled through again more quietly. At last the descriptions of the various detachments were all collected.
10,000 under Saxe Weimar, somewhere on the roads south of Erfurt," Hohenlohe said, reading the papers. "Another 17 in Halle, under Württemberg's command, our reserves. And so far we have another 8,000 here from the battle. More will surely come in."
"If the French do not overtake them,"
another man said quietly. Scharnhorst, the late Duke of Brunswick's chief of staff.
"They are moving too quickly. We cannot wait. Sire, we must get every man we have left across the Elbe and burn the bridges at once, or we will lose Berlin. We should send couriers to begin even now."
This provoked another furious explosion, nearly every man in the room shouting him down and, in their disagreement, finding a vent for all the raw violence of their feelings, which were all that one might expect from proud men, seeing their honour and that of their country rolled in the dust, and forced to learn humility and fear at the hand of a deadly and implacable enemy, whom even now they all could feel drawing close upon their heels. Lawrence, too, felt an instinctive revulsion for so ignominious a withdrawal, and the sacrifice of so much territory. Madness, it seemed to him, to give so much ground without forcing the French to do battle for any of it. Bonaparte was not the sort of man who would be satisfied even with a large bite, when he could devour the whole, and with as many dragons as he had in his train, the destruction of the bridges seemed at once an insufficient obstacle and an admission of weakness. In the tumult, the king beckoned to Hohenlohe and drew him aside before the windows to speak with him. When the rest had spent themselves in shouting, they came back to the tables.
"Prince Hohenlohe will take command of the army," the king said quietly but with finality. "We will fall back on Magdeburg to gather our forces together, and there consider how best to organize the defense of the line of the Elbe."
A low murmuring of obedience and agreement answered him, and with the queen he quitted the room. Hohenlohe began to issue orders, sending men out with dispatches, the senior officers one by one slipping away to organize their commands. Lawrence was by now almost desperate for sleep, and tired of being left waiting. When all but a handful of staff officers remained, and he still had been given no orders nor dismissed, and Hohenlohe showed every sign of once again burying himself in the maps, Lawrence finally lost patience and put himself forward.
"Sir,"
he said, interrupting Hohenlohe's study,
"may I ask to whom I am to report, or, failing that, your orders for me?"
Hohenlohe looked up and stared at him again with that hollow expression.
"Dyhern and Schliemann are made prisoner," he said after a moment. "Arbend also." "Who is left?" he asked, looking around.
His aides seemed uncertain how to answer him. Then finally one ventured,
"Do we know what has become of George?"
Some more discussion, and several men sent to make inquiries, all returned answers in the negative. Hohenlohe said finally,
"Do you mean to say there's not a single damned heavyweight left, out of 14?
Lacking either acid spitters or fire breathers, the Prussians organized their formations to maximize strength rather than, like the British, to protect a dragon with such critical offensive capabilities. The heavyweights were nearly all formation leaders, and as such had come in for particular attention in the French attack. Too, they had been peculiarly vulnerable to the French tactics, being slower and more ponderous than the middleweights who had spearheaded the boarding attempts, and much of their strength and limited agility already worn down from a day of hard flying. Lawrence had seen 5 taken on the battlefield. He did not find it wonderful that the rest should have been snapped up afterwards, or at best driven far away in the chaotic aftermath.
"Pray God some will come in overnight," Hohenlohe said. "We will have to reorganize the entire command."
He paused heavily and looked at Lawrence, both of them silenced by the awareness that Temeraire was the only heavyweight left at hand, at one stroke thus become critical to their defences and impossible to restrain. Hohenlohe could not force them to stay. Lawrence could not help being torn. In some wise his first duty was to protect the eggs, and given the disaster that surely meant to see them straight away to England. Yet to desert the Prussians now would be as good as giving the war up for lost, and pretending they could do no more to help.
"Your instructions, then, sir,"
he said abruptly. He could not bring himself to do it. Hohenlohe did not make any expressions of gratitude, but his face relaxed a little, a few of the lines easing out.
"Tomorrow morning I will ask you to go to Halle. All our reserves are there. Tell them to fall back, and if you can carry some guns for them, so much the better. We will find some work for you then. God knows there will be no shortage."
"Ow!" Temeraire said loudly.
Lawrence opened his eyes, already sitting up, his back and leg muscles protesting loudly, and his head thick and clouded besides from so little sleep. There was only a little dim light filtering in. He crawled out of his tent and discovered that this was rather the fault of the fog than the hour. The covert was already alive, and even as he stood up he saw Roland coming to wake him as she had been told to do. Canes were scrambling over Temeraire, digging out the bullets. Their precipitous departure from the battlefield after the fighting had kept him from attending to the wounds then. Though Temeraire had borne them up to now without even noticing, and far worse wounds without complaint, he flinched from their extraction, stifling small cries as Canes drew each one out, though not very thoroughly.
"It is always the same," Keynes said sourly. "You will get yourself hacked to pieces and call it entertainment, but only try and stitch you back together and you will moan without end."
"Well, it hurts a great deal more," Temeraire said. "I do not see why you must take them out. They do not bother me as they are."
"They would damn well bother you when you got blood poisoning from them. Hold still and stop whimpering."
"I am not whimpering at all," Temeraire muttered, and added, "Ow!"
There was a rich, pleasant smell in the air. Three meagre horse carcasses were all that had been delivered to the covert that morning to feed more than 10 hungry dragons. Before the inevitable jostling could begin, Gong Su had appropriated the lot. The bones he roasted in a fire pit and then stewed with the flesh in some makeshift cauldrons, the dragon's breastplates temporarily put to this new use, and all the youngest crewmen set to stirring. The ground crews he peremptorily sent out to scavenge, by means best not closely examined, whatever else they could find, which varied ingredients he picked over for inclusion. The Prussian officers looked on anxiously as their dragon's provisions all went into the vats, but the dragons caught a sort of excitement at the process of choosing which items would go in, and offered their own opinions by here nudging forward a heap of knotted yellow onions, there surreptitiously pushing away some undesirable sacks of rice. These last Gong Su did not let go to waste. He reserved some quantity of the liquid when the dragons had been served their portions, and cooked the rice separately and the rich broth swimming with scraps. So the aviators breakfasted rather better than much of the camp, a circumstance which went far to reconciling them to the strange practice. The harnesses of the dragons were all in sorry shape, clawed and frayed, some down to the wires threaded through the leather for strength, some straps entirely severed, and Temeraire's was in particularly wretched case. They had neither the time nor the supplies to make proper repairs, but some patchwork at least had to be done before their departure for Halle.
"I'm sorry, sir. With all we can do, it'll be rising noon before we can get him under leather again,"
Fellows came to say apologetically, having made a first survey of the damage and set the harness men to work.
"It's the way he twists about, I expect. Widens the tears."
"Do what you can," Lawrence said briefly. No need to press them. Every man was working to his limits, and there were as many as could be asked for, volunteers from the ground crews they had rescued. In the meantime, he coaxed Temeraire to sleep and conserve his energy. Temeraire was not unwilling, and laid himself out around the still warm ashes of the cooking fires.
"Lawrence," he said after a moment, softly, "Lawrence, have we lost?"
"Only a battle, my dear, not the war," Lawrence said, though honesty compelled him to add, "but a damnably important battle, yes. I suppose he has taken half the army prisoner and scattered the rest."
He leaned against Temeraire's foreleg, feeling very low. He had so far staved off with activity any serious contemplation of their circumstances.
"We must not yield to despair," he said, as much for himself as for Temeraire. "There is yet hope, and if there were none at all, still sitting on our hands bewailing our fate would do no good."
Temeraire sighed deeply.
"What will happen to Eroica? They will not hurt him."
"No, never," Lawrence answered. "He will be sent along to some breeding grounds, I am sure. He may even be released if they settle upon terms. Until then, they will only keep Dihun under lock and key. What the poor devil must feel."
He could well imagine all the horrors of the Prussian captain's situation, to be not only himself prevented from doing any good for his country, but the instrument of his inexpressibly valuable dragon's imprisonment. Temeraire evidently shared some very similar train of thought with respect to Eroica. He curled his foreleg in to draw Lawrence nearer and nudged him a little anxiously for petting. This reassurance only let him drop off at last. The harness men managed the repairs quicker than promised, and before 11 o'clock were beginning the laborious process of getting aboard all the enormous weight of straps and buckles and rings, with much assistance from Temeraire himself. He was the only one who could possibly have raised up the massive shoulder strap some 3 feet wide and full of chain mesh within, which anchored the whole. They were in the midst of their labours when several of the dragons looked up together, at some sound which only they could hear. In another minute they could all see a little courier coming in towards them, his flight oddly unsteady. He dropped into the centre of the field and sank down off his legs at once, deep bloody gashes along his sides, crying urgently and twisting his head around to see his captain, A boy, some 15 years of age, if so many, drooping in his straps, whose legs had been slashed badly by the same strokes which marked his dragon. They cut off the bloody harness and got the boy down. Keynes had put an iron bar in the hot ashes the moment both came down, and now clapped the searing surface to the open and oozing wounds, producing a terrible roasting smell.
"No arteries or veins cut. He'll do," was his brusque remark after he had inspected his handiwork, and he set to giving the same treatment to the dragon.
The boy revived with a little brandy splashed into his mouth and smelling salts under his nose, and he got out his message in German, gasping long, stuttering breaths between the words to keep from breaking into sobs.
"Lawrence, we were to go to Hallo, were we not?" Temeraire said, listening. "He says the French have taken the town. They attacked this morning."
"We cannot hold Berlin," Hohenlohe said. The king did not protest, he only nodded.
"How long until the French reach the city?"
the queen asked. She was very pale, but composed, with her hands lying in her lap, folded over lightly.
"The children are there."
"There is no time to waste," Hohenlohe said.
Enough of an answer. He paused and said, his voice almost breaking,
"Majesty, I beg you will forgive."
The queen sprang up and took his shoulders in her hands, kissing him on the cheek.
"We will prevail against him," she said fiercely. "Have courage. We will see you in the east."
Regaining some measure of self-control, Hohenlohe rambled on a little longer. Plans, intentions. He would rally more of the stragglers, send the artillery trains west, organize the middleweights into formations. They would fall back to the fortress of Stettin. They would defend the line of the Oder. He did not sound as though he believed any of it. Lawrence stood uncomfortably in the corner of the room, as far away as he could manage.
"Will you take their majesties?"
Hohenlohe had asked, heavily, when Lawrence had first told him the news.
"Surely you will need us here, sir," Lawrence had said. "A fast courier."
But Hohenlohe had shaken his head.
"After what happened to this one, bringing the news? No, we cannot take such a risk. Their patrols will be out in force all around us."
The king now raised the same objection, and was answered the same way.
"You cannot be taken," Hohenlohe said. "It would be the end, sire. He could dictate whatever terms he desired. Or, God forbid, if you should be killed, and the Crown Prince still in Berlin, when they come there."
"Oh, God, my children in that monster's power," the queen said. "We cannot stand here talking. Let us go at once."
She went to the door and called her maid, waiting outside, to go and fetch a coat.
"Will you be all right?" the king asked her quietly. "What, am I a child to be afraid?"
she said scornfully.
"I have been flying on couriers. It cannot be very different."
But a courier twice the size of a horse was not to be compared with a heavy weight bigger than the whole barn.
"Is that your dragon, on the hill over there?" she asked Lawrence, as they came into view of the covert.
Lawrence saw no hill, and then realized she was pointing at the middling-sized Berhesi sleeping on Temeraire's back. Before Lawrence could correct her, Temeraire himself lifted up his head and looked in their direction.
"Oh,"
she said, a little faintly. Lawrence, who remembered when Temeraire had been small enough to fit into a hammock aboard the Reliant, still in some part did not think of him being quite so large as he really was.
"He is perfectly gentle," he said, in an awkward attempt at reassurance.
Also a brazen lie, since Temeraire had just enthusiastically spent the previous day in the most violent pursuits imaginable. But it seemed the thing to say. All the dragon crews sprang up, startled, to their feet, as the royal couple entered the makeshift covert, and remained at stiff and awkward attention. Aviators were not used to being so graced, as the little couriers who ordinarily bore important passengers went to their lodgings to carry them to and fro. Neither monarch looked very easy, particularly when all the dragons, catching their crew's excitement, began craning their heads to peer at them. But with true grace the king took the queen's arm in his, and went around to speak to the captains and give each a few words of approval. Lawrence seized the moment and beckoned hurriedly to Granby and Fellows.
"Can we get a tent put up for them aboard?"
he asked urgently.
"I don't know we can, sir. We left all behind what we could spare, running from the battlefield, and that lummox Bell had out the tents to make room for his kit, as though we couldn't work him up a tanning barrel anywhere we went,"
Fellows said, rubbing at the back of his neck nervously.
"But we'll manage something. If you can give me a turn of the glass, maybe some of these other fellows can lend us a bit of scrap."
The tent was indeed managed out of two pieces of spare leather sewn together. Personal harnesses were cobbled together. A half-respectable cold supper was hastily assembled and packed into a basket with even a bottle of wine, though how this should be opened mid-flight without disaster Lawrence had not the least idea.
"If you are ready, Your Majesty," he said tentatively, and offered the Queen his arm when she nodded. "Temeraire, will you put us up? Very carefully, if you please."
Temeraire obligingly put down his claw for them to step into. She looked at it a little palely. The nails of his talons were roughly the length of her forearm and of polished black horn, sharp along the edges and coming to a wicked point.
"Shall I go first?" the King said to her quietly.
She threw her head back and said,
"No, of course not,"
and stepped in, though she could not help but throw an anxious look at the talons curving above her head. Temeraire was regarding her with great interest, and having let her step off again onto his shoulder, he whispered,
"Lawrence, I always thought queens would have a great many jewels, but she has none at all. Have they been stolen?"
Fortunately, he spoke in English, as otherwise this remark would not have been much of a secret, issuing as it did from jaws large enough to swallow a horse. Lawrence hurried the Queen into the tent before Temeraire could shift to German or French, and take to questioning her on the state of her array. She very sensibly wore a plain heavy overcoat of wool over her gown, adorned with nothing more elaborate than silver buttons, and a fur pelisse and hat, practical enough on a flight. The King had the benefit at least of a military officer's experience of dragons, and showed no hesitation, if he felt any. But the retinue of guards and servants looked more deeply anxious even at coming near. Looking at their pale faces, the King said something briefly in German. Lawrence guessed from the looks of shamefacedness and relief that he was giving them permission to stay behind. Temeraire took this opportunity to put in his own remarks in that language, provoking startled looks all around, and he then stretched out his foreleg towards the group. This did not quite have the effect that Lawrence imagined Temeraire had intended, and a few moments later there were left only four of the royal guard and one old woman servant, who snorted profoundly and climbed without ceremony into Temeraire's hand to be put aboard.
"What did you say to them?" Lawrence asked, half amused and half despairing.
"I only told them they were being very silly," Temeraire said in injured tones, "and that if I meant to do them any harm, it would be much easier for me to reach them where they were standing anyway than if they were on my back."
Berlin was in a ferment. The townspeople looked without love on soldiers in uniform, and Lawrence, going through the town in haste, trying to get what supplies he could, heard muttering about the damned war party in every shop and corner. News of the terrible loss had already reached them, along with news of the French drive on the city. But there was no spirit of resistance or revolt, or even any great unhappiness. Indeed, the general impression was a kind of sullen satisfaction at being proven right.
"They drove the poor king to it, you know, the queen and all those other young hotheads," the banker told Lawrence. "They would prove that they could beat Bonaparte, and they could not. And who is it that pays for their pride but us, I ask you? So many poor young men killed, and what our taxes will be after this, I do not want to think."
Having delivered himself of these criticisms, however, he was quite willing to advance Lawrence a good sum in gold.
"I had rather have my money in an account at Drummond's than here in Berlin, if there's a hungry army marching in," he said candidly, while his two sons lugged up a small but substantial chest.
The British embassy was in turmoil, the ambassador already gone by courier, and scarcely anyone left could give him good information, or would. His green coat commanded not the least attention, beyond queries if he were a courier bringing dispatches.
"There has been no trouble in India these 3 years. Why ever should you ask such a thing?"
a harried secretary said impatiently, when Lawrence at last resorted to halting him in the corridor by main force.
"I have not the least understanding why the corps should have failed in our obligations, but it is just as well we had not more committed to this route."
This political view Lawrence could not easily subscribe to, still more angry and ashamed to hear the corps described in such a way. He closed his mouth on the reply which first sprang to mind, and said only, very cold,
"Have you all safe route of escape?"
"Yes, of course," the secretary said. "We will embark at Stralsund. You had best get back to England straight away yourself. The navy is in the Baltic and in the North Sea to assist with operations in support of Danzig and Königsberg, for whatever good that will do, but at least you will have a clear route home once you are over the sea."
If a craven piece of advice, this at least was reassuring news. But there were no letters of his own waiting, which might have given him an explanation less painful to consider, and of course none would find them now.
"I cannot even send a new direction home with them," Lawrence said to Granby as they walked back towards the palace. "God only knows where we shall be in 2 days, much less a week. Anyone would have to address it to William Lawrence, East Prussia, and throw it into the ocean in a bottle, too, for all the likelihood it should find me."
"Lawrence," Granby said abruptly, "I hope to God you will not think me chicken-hearted. But oughtn't we be getting home, as he said?"
He gazed straight ahead down the street and avoided Lawrence's eyes as he spoke. There was alternating colour and pallid white in his cheeks. It abruptly occurred to Lawrence, to be compounded with his other cares, that his decision to stay might look to the Admiralty as though he were keeping the egg out in the field intentionally, delaying until Granby might have his chance.
"The Prussians are too badly short of heavyweights now to let us go," he said finally.
Not really an answer. Granby did not answer again until later, when they had come to Lawrence's quarters and might shut the door behind them. In that privacy he bluntly said,
"Then they can't stop us going, either!"
Lawrence was silent over the brandy glasses. He could not deny it, nor even criticise, having entertained much the same thought himself. Granby added,
"They've lost, Lawrence. Half their army and half the country, too. Surely there's no sense in staying now!"
"I will not allow their final loss to be certain," Lawrence said strongly at this discouraged remark, turning around at once. "The most terrible sequence of defeats may yet be reversed, so long as men are to be had and they do not despair, and it is the duty of an officer to keep them from doing so. I trust I need not insist upon your confining such sentiments to your breast."
Granby flushed up crimson and answered with some heat.
"I am not proposing to go running around crying that the sky is falling, but they'll need us at home more than ever. Bonaparte is sure to already be looking across the channel with one eye."
"We did not stay only to avoid pursuit or challenge," Lawrence said, "but because it is better to fight Bonaparte farther from home. That reason yet remains. If there were no real hope, or if our efforts could make no material difference, then I would say yes. But to desert in this situation, when our assistance may be of the most vital importance, I cannot countenance."
"Do you honestly think they will manage any better than they have so far? He's overmatched them start to finish, and they are in worse case now than they were to start."
This there was no denying, but Lawrence said,
"Painful as the lesson has been, we have surely learnt much of his mind, of his strategy, from this meeting. The Prussian commanders cannot fail to now revise their strategy, which I fear before this first contest of arms had too much to do with overconfidence."
"As far as that goes, too much is better than too little," Granby said, "and I see precious little reason for any confidence at all."
"I hope I will never be so rash as to say I am confident of dealing Bonaparte a reversal," Lawrence said. "But there remains good and practical reason to hope. Recall that even now the Prussian reserves in the east, together with the Russian army, will outmatch Bonaparte's numbers by half again, and the French cannot venture forward until they have secured their lines of communication. There are a dozen fortresses of vital strategic importance fended by strong garrisons, which they will first have to besiege and then leave troops to secure."
But this was only parroting. He knew perfectly well numbers alone did not tell the course of battle. Bonaparte had been outnumbered at Jena. He paced the room for another hour when Granby had at last gone. It was his duty to show himself more certain than he was, and besides that, to not permit himself to be downhearted, sentiments which should surely convey themselves to the men. But he was not wholly sure of the course he was following, and he knew that his decision was in some part formed by his disgust for the notion. Desertion, even from a situation into which he had effectively been pressed, had too much an ugly and dishonourable ring to it, and he had not the happy turn of character which might have allowed him to call it by another name and lose the odium thereby.
"I do not want to give up either, though I would like to be at home," Temeraire said with a sigh. "It is not so nice, losing battles and seeing our friends taken prisoner. I hope it is not upsetting the eggs," he added, anxious despite all of Keynes's reassurances, and bent over to nudge them gently and carefully with his nose where they lay in their nests, presently tucked between two warming braziers under a ledge in the main courtyard of the palace, waiting to be loaded aboard. The king and queen were saying their farewells. They were sending the royal children away by courier to the well-protected fortress of Königsberg, deep in East Prussia.
"You ought to go with them," the king said softly.
but the Queen shook her head and kissed her children good-bye swiftly.
"I do not want to go away either, mother. Let me come too," said the second prince,
a sturdy boy of 9, and he was only packed off with difficulty and in the face of loud protests. They stood together watching until the little courier dragons dwindled to bird specks and vanished, before at last they climbed back aboard Temeraire for the journey eastward with a handful of their retinue brave enough to venture it, a small and sad party. Overnight a steady stream of bad news had flowed into the city, though at least these pieces of intelligence had been largely expected, if not so soon. Saxe-Weimar's detachment caught by Marshal Davout, every last man of 10,000 killed or taken prisoner, Bernadotte already at Magdeburg, cutting Hohenlohe off, the Elbe crossings falling into French hands, not a single bridge destroyed, Bonaparte himself already on the road to Berlin, and when Temeraire rose up into the air, they could see, not very distant, the smoke and dust of the oncoming army, marching, marching, with a cloud of dragons overhead. They spent the night at a fortress on the Oder River. The commander and his men had not even heard rumours and were bitterly shocked by news of the defeat. Lawrence suffered through the dinner which the commander felt it necessary to give, a black and silent meal, quenched by the officer's depression and the natural embarrassment attendant on dining in the presence of royalty. The small walled covert attached to the fortress was barren and dusty and uncomfortable, and Lawrence escaped to it and his meagre bivouac of straw with great relief. He woke to a soft, rolling patter like fingertips on a drum, a steady grey rain falling against Temeraire's wings, which he had spread over them protectively. There would be no fire that morning. Lawrence had a cup of coffee inside, looking over the maps and working out the compass directions for the day's flight. They were trying to find the eastern reserves of the army under command of General Lestock, somewhere in the Polish territories which Prussia had lately acquired.
"We will make for Posen," the king said tiredly. He did not look as though he had slept very well. "There will be at least a detachment in the city if Lestock is not there yet himself."
The rain did not slacken all the day, and sluggish bands of fog drifted through the valleys below them. They flew through a grey formlessness, following the compass and the turns of the hourglass, counting Temeraire's wing-beats and marking his speed. Darkness was almost welcome. The crosswind that blew the rain in their faces slackened, and they could huddle a little warmer in their leather coats. Villages in the fields disappeared as they flew overhead. They saw no other signs of life until, crossing a deep river valley, they flew over 5 dragons, ferals, sleeping upon a sheltered ledge, who lifted up their heads at Temeraire's passage. They leapt off the ledge and came flying towards Temeraire. Lawrence grew anxious lest they either provoke a quarrel or try and follow them, like Arcady and the mountain ferals. But they were small, gregarious creatures, and only flew alongside Temeraire a while, jeering wordlessly and making demonstrations of their flying abilities, back-wing swoops and steep dives. Half an hour's flight brought them to the edge of the valley, and there the ferals, with piercing cries, broke off and circled back away into their territory.
"I could not understand them," Temeraire said, looking over his shoulder after them. "I wonder what that language is that they are speaking. It sounds a little bit like Durzac in places, but it was too different to make out, at least when they spoke so quickly."
They did not reach the city that night after all. Some 20 miles short, they came upon the small and sodden campfires of the army, settling into miserable, wet bivouacs for the night. General Lestock came to the covert himself to greet the king and queen, with sedan chairs drawn up as close as he could persuade the bearers to come. He had evidently been warned to expect them, likely by a courier. Lawrence was naturally not invited to accompany them, but neither was he offered the simple courtesy of a billet, and the staff officer who stayed to see their supply was offensively short in his hurry to be gone.
"No," Lawrence said with mounting impatience, "no, half a sheep will not do. He has had a 90 miles flight today in bad weather, and he damn well will be fed accordingly. You do not look to me as though this army were on short commons."
The officer was at length compelled to provide a cow, but the rest of them had a wet and hungry night, receiving only some thin oat porridge and biscuit and no meat ration at all. Perhaps a spiteful revenge. Lestock had with him only a small corps, 2 formations of smallish heavyweights, nowhere near Temeraire's size, with 4 middleweight winged dragons apiece, and a few courier dragons for leaven. Their comfort had been equally neglected. The men were sleeping mostly distributed upon the backs of their dragons, only a few smallish tents posted for officers. After they had unloaded him, Temeraire nosed around, here and there, trying to find some drier place to rest, without success. The bare ground of the covert was nothing but mud, 2 full inches down.
"You had better just lie down," Keynes said. "The mud will keep you warm enough, once you were in it properly." "Surely it cannot be healthy," Lawrence said dubiously. "Nonsense," Keynes said. "What do you think a mustard plaster is but mud? So long as he does not lie in it for a week, he will do perfectly well."
"Wait! Wait!" Gong Su said unexpectedly. He had been gradually acquiring English, being isolated otherwise, but he was still shy of speaking out, save where his business of cookery was concerned. He went through his jars and spice bags hurriedly and brought out a jar of ground red pepper, a few pinches of which Lawrence had seen him use to flavour an entire cow. He put on a glove and ran beneath Temeraire's belly, scattering a double handful of it upon the ground, while Temeraire peered at him curiously from between his legs.
"There! Now we'll be warm!" Gong Su said, stepping out and sealing tight the jar again.
Temeraire gingerly let himself down into the muck, which made rude noises as it squelched up around his sides.
"Ugh!" he said. "How I miss the pavilions in China! This is not at all pleasant!"
He squirmed a little.
"It is warm, but it feels quite odd."
Lawrence could not like having Temeraire thus marinated, but there was little hope of doing better by him tonight at least. Indeed, he recalled that even while with the larger corps under Hohenlohe's command they had received little better accommodations, only the milder weather had rendered their circumstances more comfortable. Granby and his men did not seem to take it as he did, shrugging.
"I suppose it's what we're used to," Granby said. "When I was with Litivikat in India, once they put us on the day's battlefield with a wounded moaning away all night and bits of swords and bayonets everywhere, because they didn't want to be put to the trouble of clearing some brush away for us to sleep elsewhere. Captain Portland had to threaten to desert to get them to move it the next morning."
Lawrence had spent his career as an aviator so far entirely in the highly comfortable training covert at Loch Laggan, and in the long-established one at Dover, which, if nothing like what the Chinese considered adequate, at least offered well-drained clearings, shaded by trees, with barracks for the men and junior officers, and rooms at the headquarters for the captains and senior lieutenants. He supposed, perhaps, he was unrealistic to expect good conditions in the field, with an army on the march, but surely something better might have been arranged. There were hills visible not very distant, certainly within an easy quarter of an hour's flight, where the ground would not have been so thoroughly soaked.
"What can we do for the eggs?"
he asked Keynes. At present the 2 large bundles were standing upon a handful of chests draped over with an oilskin.
"Will they take any harm from the cold?"
"I am trying to think," Keynes said irritably. He was pacing around Temeraire.
"Will you be sure not to roll onto them in the night?"
he demanded of the dragon.
"Of course I'm not going to roll onto the eggs," Temeraire said, outraged.
"Then we had better wrap them in oilskins and bury them up against his side in the mud,"
Keynes said to Lawrence, ignoring Temeraire's muttered indignations. "There's no hope of starting a fire that will keep in this rain." The men were already all as wet as they could be. By the time they had finished digging a hole they were also all over mud, but at least they had warmed up by the exercise. Lawrence himself had stood out the whole while being drenched, feeling it his place to share the discomfort.
"Share out the rest of the oilskins and let everyone sleep aboard," he said,
once the eggs were safely tucked into their nest, and gratefully climbed up to his own shelter for the night. The tent, now vacant, had been left up on Temeraire's back for him. Having covered nearly 200 miles in 2 days of flying, it was an unwelcome reversion to find themselves once again leashed by the infantry, and, worse, by the endless trail of supply wagons which it seemed were stuck as often as they were moving. The roads were terrible, unpaved sand and dirt that churned and squelched under every step, and littered with fallen leaves, wet and slippery. The army was moving eastward, in hopes of a rendezvous with the Russians. Even in the wretched conditions, labouring under the news of defeat, the discipline did not fail, and the column marched along in steady order. Lawrence found he had been unjust to the supply officer. They were indeed on short rations. Though the harvest had just been brought in, there seemed to be nothing available anywhere in the countryside, at least not to them. The Poles showed empty hands when asked to sell, no matter what money they were offered. The crops had been bad, the herds had been sick, they said, if pressed, and showed empty granaries and pens. Though the black, shiny eyes of pigs and cattle might occasionally be glimpsed, peeking out from the dark woods behind their fields, and occasionally some enterprising officer unearthed a cache of grain or potatoes hidden in a cellar or beneath a trap door. There were no exceptions, not even for Lawrence's offers of gold, not even in houses where the children were too thin and scantily dressed against the coming winter. And once in a small cottage little better than a hovel, when in exasperation he doubled the gold in his palm and held it out again with a pointed look at the baby lying scarcely covered in its cradle, the young matron of the house looked at him with mute reproach, and pushed his fingers closed over it before she pointed at the door. Lawrence went out again rather ashamed of himself. He was anxious for Temeraire, who was not getting enough to eat, but he could hardly blame the Poles for resenting the partition and occupation of their country. It had been a shameful business, much deplored in his father's political circles, and Lawrence thought perhaps the government had made some sort of formal protest, though he did not properly remember. It would hardly have made a difference. Hungry for land, Russia and Austria and Prussia would not have listened. They had all pushed their borders out piece by piece, ignoring the cries for justice from their weaker neighbour, until at last they had met in the middle, and there was no more country left in between. Small wonder that the soldiers of one of those nations should meet a cool reception now. They took 2 days to cross the 20 miles to Posen, and found an even colder welcome there, and a more dangerous one. Rumours had already reached the town. With the arrival of the army, the disaster at Jena could hardly be a secret, and more news came pouring in. Hohenlohe had finally surrendered with the tattered remnants of his infantry, and with that, all of Prussia, west of the Oder, was falling like a house of cards. The French Marshal Murat was repeating all over the country the same trick that had worked so nicely for him at Erfurt, seizing fortresses one after another with no weapon but brass cheek. His simple method was to present himself at their stoop, announce that he had come to receive their surrender, and wait until the doors were opened and the governor let him in. But when the governor at Stettin, several hundred miles from the battlefield, and as yet wholly ignorant of what had occurred, indignantly refused this charming request, the iron beneath the brass plating was revealed. 2 days later there were 30 dragoons and 30 guns and 5,000 men outside the walls, busily digging trenches and piling up bombs in very noticeable heaps for a full assault, and the governor meekly handed over the keys and his garrison. Lawrence overheard this story told some 5 times in one walk around the town's marketplace square. He did not understand the language, but the same names would keep ringing out together in tones not merely amused, but exultant. Men sitting together, murmuring in ale-houses, were raising their vodka glasses to Vive l'Empereur when there was no Prussian in hearing distance, and sometimes even when there was, depending on how low the level in the bottle had gone. There was an atmosphere of belligerence and hope mingled. He put his head in at every market stall he could find. Here at least the merchants could not refuse to sell what was plainly in sight, but supplies in the town were not much more plentiful, and had for the most part already been appropriated. After much searching, Lawrence was able only to find one poor, small pig. He paid some 5 times its value, and at once had it knocked smartly over the head with a cudgel to stun it, and trundled to its doom in a wheelbarrow by one of the harness men. Temeraire took it and ate it raw, too hungry to wait for cooking, and painstakingly licked clean his talons afterwards.